The Buckmaster Radio Program is paid for by Buckmaster Communications, LLC. The views expressed are not necessarily those of KVOI, Bill Buckmaster Communications, LLC, or their sponsors.
Well, it's 12 o'clock. It's Tuesday. The market is kind of taking care of itself today. It's Tuesday, so it's not necessarily in a good way. And this is Shelley Fishman sitting in for Bill Buckmaster, who is still on vacation, but he'll be back next week. We're broadcasting from the Green Things Socolow Village studio, and I am really going to emphasize that the Buckmaster Live Line is presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management, and that live line is 520-790-2040. And the reason I'm so big on that is because this is show two, hour two, of a conversation that we're having with two professors from the U of A. Professor Brinton Millward, the School of Government and Public Policy, and Professor Michael Schaller, the Regents Professor Emeritus of History from the U of A. This has been just a tremendous first hour where we talked about the fact that for whatever reasons, and we'll get into those even more, we have engineered a society somehow that makes it harder and less attractive for individuals to rise into and through the middle class, harder than it was for me as a boomer. And, you know, exploring some of the ways we've done that and some of the reasons we've done that is really important, especially when you take a look at the resentment intergenerationally that we're seeing from some of the younger folks today. And by younger, I mean anybody, you know, below the age of 60, who just feel like we in the boomer generation, the greatest generation, had all of this stuff handed to us, and then we took advantage of it and then slammed the door behind us. So one of the questions is, did we do that? And the other question is, what do we do about it? And last week, in talking about this, we were reviewing history, and we kind of got up to about 1980. You know, we talked about the 60s and the Cultural Revolutions, and we talked about the Vietnam War and just how different everything seemed to be getting. And then we come to 1980, and something weird happened. What happened in 1980? Mike?
Well, I think, put it most simply, history sort of caught up with America.
Yeah.
A sense of disillusionment, a sense of government, as Ronald Reagan famously said in his inauguration, government isn't the solution, government's the problem. But, and which really changed the way Americans looked at their own government from what they felt from the 1930s on. But it didn't come out of nowhere. And I think It's important to just say a few things that set the tone for sort of the sense of decline in America. And, you know, one was the Watergate crisis,
sure,
of the early 70s. The notion that, you know, the president was a crook, that was certainly disillusioned to many Americans. And then the collapse of Vietnam, even though the majority of Americans by 1974 had thought that Vietnam was probably a mistake, the collapse, which was responded to like it was in Afghanistan.
So what I hear you saying is that the reaction that led to the Reagan Revolution was not so much a reaction against the cultural changes that were happening, but a reaction against government and the fact that a lot of the fixes that had happened since before World War II were government-sponsored and government intended.
I think that's actually exactly correct, along with real economic changes in the 70s. You know, the loss of union jobs and manufacturing jobs, the energy crises of the 1970s, a series of oil embargoes, the sense of what Reagan called the Vietnam syndrome, that America no longer had pride of place in the world. Our enemies didn't fear us. Our friends didn't rely on us. You had a series of what were seen almost as accidental presidents. Gerald Ford taking over from Nixon. Jimmy Carter, kind of a fluke historically.
Right.
And the sense that things just were running down by the late 1970s. And again, energy, loss of jobs, decline in union membership, the collapse of detente.
And the people who felt this the most seriously were those who could afford the least feel it.
That's right. I mean, it sort of hurt certainly the lower half of the economic strata most.
Right. So, you know, we've always had divisiveness in this country and political divisiveness, but something felt different. I mean, by 1980, I was, 35 years old or something like that. And it just felt that something was wrong.
You know, you saw it in one way in one basic polling question. Do you think your children will be better off than you are?
Right.
And, you know, for 40 years, the answer is generally yes. And starting in the late 70s and early 80s, the answer was no.
Hmm. So, Brent, when we were just kind of preparing the show, we talked a little bit of, you know, solutions, but we also talked a little bit about the fact that in offshoring, a lot of our manufacturing and the changes to the economic model worldwide, we had somehow done the worst of both worlds. It wasn't our intent to make things worse, but we somehow did.
Well, it's really interesting. One of the things that people who study public policy realize is that solutions cause problems.
Yes.
And one of the solutions to sort of slow economic growth is to free up industry. So if you do, they may decide that they're going to move some of their production to Mexico, even later to Vietnam, to Nike, for example, is a great example of the hollow corporation, where almost all of the shoes and everything that it manufactured from the very beginning was done overseas. And what this does is produce very inexpensive stuff, relatively, to buy in the United States, but it also is an example of offshoring of the kinds of work that used to be done primarily in the American South, which had much lower cost of labor than places in the United States that had labor unions that were very strong.
So the good news is that the bottom half of earners were able to still afford the things they needed and wanted because the prices for those things had come down despite inflation in the 70s. The bad news was that the jobs that they had had to create that stuff were going away.
Well, there's another element here as well, and that is you deregulated the economy. In many ways, one of the things that I was thinking about when I was preparing for the show was what the world used to look like in the 1970s. You had a lot of regional banks. You had state chartered banks. You had a lot of savings and loans. You had a lot of more localized insurance companies that provided a lot of middle class jobs to folks in those areas. The whole economy was concentrating, and so companies became bigger, and that's one of the reasons for the run-up in the stock market. But it really reduced the kinds of middle-class jobs that earlier generations have been able to take advantage of.
As a result of deregulation and not enforcing some of the antitrust laws that had been aggressively enforced earlier.
But again, this was a solution. The deregulation was a solution to many of the problems you had with stagflation and the lack of economic growth during the 1970s.
It was a proposed solution.
A proposed solution, right.
And to some extent, we implemented that kind of solution.
Certainly the Reagan administration did.
Absolutely. And the first Bush administration.
Right.
Also, technology.
Yep.
It's one thing to manufacture a pair of Nike shoes in Hanoi. It's another thing to profitably sell it in Omaha. And the only way you could really do that was through mass ocean shipping with cargo containers.
Sure. So we deregulate industry. The unintended consequence is a lot of manufacturing gets offshored. We cut taxes, and we haven't really talked about that, but Reagan certainly went a long way toward cutting taxes. And therefore, we started seeing deficits in a peacetime economy. And that made it more difficult for the federal government and also local and state government, local and state and local governments to provide the kinds of services that I was able to take advantage of as a kid growing up, such as free college. So it wasn't the intended consequence, but there it was. Cities were having a harder time keeping the lights on.
Well, you know, one of the things that we might want to think of is that when you take a look at sort of the Reagan Revolution, and you take a look at all the ideas, I mean, one of the things about the right at this time is they had the good ideas. Sort of, we talked about last time is sort of liberalism ran out of ideas in the 1960s, 1970s. And so, well, some of these ideas are that things like education is a personal good. It's not something that necessarily is a collective good. And so if that's the case, why shouldn't people have to pay for education? Why should all of us as taxpayers have to pay for education? So you see the movement to vouchers, the movement to increase the price of tuition at state colleges and universities, which is, you know, last mm-hmm. time we talked about the fact that we essentially went free. You know, I paid $300 a semester at the University of Kentucky.
Well, if you take a look at the U of A and look at its charter, it specifically says as close to free as possible.
So I would just say that ideas make a difference.
Uh-huh.
And the ideas were that many of the things that society provided collectively were now the responsibility of individuals, that it was the family that was responsible for basically providing what had been viewed as collective goods.
That is a massively important thing to talk about, thing to understand, that even though we were doing things very specifically like cutting taxes and deregulating industry and talking about government as being the problem, the mindset that both contributed to that and then was reinforced by it was to individualize those responsibilities, if I hear you correctly.
And that was one thing. The other thing was there were just a lot of baby boomers. So the cost of education went up far more than it had before. 73 million people in the United right. States were born between 1946 and 1964.
So that would have happened, as we say in Brooklyn, irregardless.
I mean, that's the pig in the python.
That's the pig in the python. You know, this is a great point to come back to and to take a break. Let's do that, and I need to point out that this portion of the Buckmaster Show has been presented by Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Kringle. Mona's is located on the northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. Mona's is open Tuesday through Sunday for breakfast and lunch. Treat yourself to their mouth-watering pastries, including the famous Danish Kringle. Forget about the calories. The stuff just really tastes great. Take a look at Mona's on the web at monasdanishbakery.com, or you can always go through the buckmastershow.com link to get to a link to Mona's Danish Bakery. We'll be right back.
Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan includes roadway, transit, pedestrian, bicycle, and many other transportation improvements across the region. Pima County voters approved the plan in 2006, and the RTA is working with the Citizens Advisory Committee to prepare and present a new draft plan as early as 2023 for public review. Learn more about the process at rtanext.com.
Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
Have you always wanted to cruise to Alaska? If that's the case, then you'll only see the tip of the iceberg. At Bon Voyage Travel, we can package the full Alaska experience with a cruise tour. Journey to Denali National Park on glass-domed rail cars. Tour the tundra wilderness and see the northern lights with an expert guide. And of course, relax on your cruise as you enjoy the glaciers up close and personal. Go to bvtravel.com today. Bon Voyage Travel, your Alaska experts.
This is Kate Delaney. Tune in later tonight as we talk about everything that happened throughout your day. Tonight at 10 on 1030 KVOI, The Voice.
And we're back. Shelley Fishman sitting in for the vacationing Bill Buckmaster, and thrilled and honored to have Professor Brent Millward and Professor Mike Schaller from the U of A here in studio with me talking about, you know, stuff that's happened in the past 50 years. It may not be so pleasant, but, you know, it's stuff that has really affected everybody in this country in so many ways. We're going to start this segment with a caller coming in. Robert, you've called in with a comment. So, Robert, thanks for calling. What's your comment?
Shelley, you were mentioning that things kind of went wanky around 1980. That was the influx of women in the workplace, and every capitalist jackal piled on, and that includes the U of A. Now, if you need proof of that, go to NewYorkPost.com, because the U of A is prominently featured in what is probably the most shameful photo taken on the mall during graduation.
So, Robert, thank you for that comment. I'm not going to try to understand whether you think that was a good thing or a bad thing, but let's get the professors to kind of talk about the fact that more and more, since maybe 1980, since maybe a little bit before then, we have women in the workplace on a you know, more and more equal footing.
Well, besides the cultural aspects of it, there's an economic reason. Families couldn't maintain their standard of living with a single worker. You know, from the post-World War II through the 1970s, a Ford production line worker or U.S. steel worker could basically support a family of four with a single wage earner. By 1980, they couldn't. And to maintain, you know, you could say women in labor is a good thing or a bad thing, but it was a necessary thing. And women entering the workplace was to compensate in part for the declining standard of living that working class people would otherwise have experienced.
Right. And have you experienced that at the university? I'm sure you have, certainly in the education community, but also in the medical community. I mean, what is it, like 55% now of graduating physicians are mm-hmm. women?
Well, it varies by field,
sure.
But clearly, I mean, the number of women you find at the U of A from the time I started there as a professor in 1988 to the present is unbelievable.
Right.
And it's certainly in my program, I would say this is in the School of Government and Public Policy. It would probably be around 60%, female now.
Okay, okay. Let's not get into the issue of pay equity. It's a whole other issue, and it's a very important one, but not really our subject today. We have another caller. Matt, you're on the line. Thanks for calling. What's your comment?
Well, yeah, generally speaking, just I know you guys did a recap of history, and I think it was pretty much right on. The only thing that I would say is that we have to keep reminding everybody. First of all, I didn't hear the word New Deal. And I think the New Deal really took us into, basically turned America into a modern world, and gave us a way of basically showing the rest of the world that, you know, we could, they could modernize with practical government policies.
Sure, sure. Matt is a friend of the show, by the way, guys, we're lucky to have him as a friend of the show. Brent, you wanted to comment on that.
Well, I want to follow up that with that, Matt. I mean, it's really interesting that you say that because, again, success leads to problems. And in the United States, we have record numbers of people living beyond 65. And people are less likely to die from heart attacks or strokes. But this means higher healthcare costs as they struggle with the problems of old age like dementia. But no one wants to go back to an age when cardiovascular medicine was less effective. Let's just think about your comment about the New Deal. Less than 100 years ago, there was no Social Security for the elderly. Less than 60 years ago, there was no Medicare. So that's the Great Society with Lyndon Johnson. Now, both programs suffer from high costs because we live longer and the medical treatments that keep us that way are expensive.
Mike?
Well, I would agree, and I certainly agree with Matt's comment about the New Deal being a real inflection point in American history, where the notion that the government had an active role to play in the economic, social, cultural life of Americans. So I fully agree with that.
And then came the Reagan Revolution. And
yeah. Now, you know, Reagan didn't repeal the New Deal, but it's, you know, or the philosophy of the New Deal, but he certainly modified it. And one of the things that was modified and we still live with today is the notion of taxes. You know, nobody likes to pay taxes, but of course, as I think one Supreme Court justice once said, it's the price we pay for a civilized society.
Oh, sure.
And starting in the 80s, there was a notion that taxes, federal taxes, income taxes, interfered with productivity, with economic growth, and so forth. So the lower you cut taxes, the more you reduce them, the more you unleashed economic productivity.
That was the theory.
That was the theory. The practice hasn't exactly worked out. It's very hard to say exactly what causes economic growth. But the one thing we can say is that there's very little historical data that shows taxes in isolation account for economic growth or prosperity.
Well, now you're in my, you know, lane, if you will, in terms of, you know, the economy. But I think we have forgotten just how dramatic the Reagan tax cuts were, especially as compared to where we were, say, in the 1960s or the end of the 1950s. I mean, top tax rates went from 96% in some cases, down to, I think Reagan brought them down to 48, and today they're at, what, 32?
Yeah.
So you can't do that without expecting that there's going to be some effect on the ability of government to do stuff.
I think it's important to say, though, whenever we discuss taxes, it's important to say what's taxed. You can have a tax rate of 1% or 99%, but what are you taxing exactly? And one of the things that did change under Reagan and Republican successors is that lots of sources of income were excluded from taxation.
Right.
And so the rate was less important than what was being taxed. I remember my accountant, local accountant, once said, you know, we were talking about flat taxes. And he said, the issue isn't whether it's a flat tax at 12% or 20%. The issue is what's taxed. And what we've seen is increasingly sources of wealth aren't taxed.
Well, that's right. And to make matters even more complex, that taxation can appear during the lifetime of the asset owner.
Yeah.
But it can also appear when those assets transfer from one generation to the next. And we talk about the fact that the boomer generation is going to be transferring massive amounts of wealth to the next generations. However, most of it ain't going to get taxed.
Well, specifically, $78.3 trillion is what's going to be transferred from the boomers to the Gen Xers and the millennials and any others in there. But the thing that is really striking, and this follows up exactly what both of you were talking about, the scale of this transfer is made possible by the U.S. tax code. Individuals can transmit up to $12.9 million to their heirs during life or at death without federal estate tax, and $26 million for married couples. So talking about what's taxed and what isn't, the great transfer of wealth from the boomers to other generations is going to be largely untaxed.
And we should comment that move to such a large number has only happened in the past generation. In other words, when I started in financial planning, I think we were at 1 million. Then it went to 3 million per person. And then only recently, it went to over 12 per person. That's $26 million per couple that get transferred without. So there's no taxes on it during lifetime. Then it gets transferred at the value on the date of death, so that eliminates the possibility of capital gains taxes, and a lot of it gets transferred without taxes anyway. This is a great place to take a break. We'll take that break. We'll come back with Professors Millward and Schaller, and we'll start talking about some solutions if we can. But for now, let's take a break, and we'll come back after the news.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Family owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for Marketplace Trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
And we're back. Shelley Fishman sitting in for Bill Buckmaster. And in the studio with me, Professor Brenton Millward and Mike Schaller from the U of A, talking about stuff that's happened that's made it harder for people to get into the middle class today than it was when I was a kid. We are broadcasting from the Green Things Socolow Village studio, and remind everybody that the Buckmaster Live line is 520-790-2040, and we encourage you to call in with your comments. So when we stopped before the break, we were talking about taxation and the fact that unintended consequences happen when you think you're doing the right thing from a policy perspective. And I think, Mike, you were wanting to pick up on that point.
I was just going to say the decisions by Congress since the 1980s to largely eliminate the estate tax on great wealth. One of the justifications for it was a classic. It was to protect the family farm upon the death of the farmer, that the sons, as it were, could inherit it. But the estate tax would strip them. They would have to sell it to pay the taxes. And this was trotted out in almost every Congress over the last 40 years. The only trouble is nobody can ever find an example of that.
And because, you can write it out.
Right, because most agricultural inherited wealth was given a carve-out, so they didn't have to sell the family farm.
You know, as usual, the issue isn't necessarily the substance of what you do. It's how you do it and what the quantity is. And as we were talking in the break, you know, zero taxes and nobody works, 100% taxes and you know, nobody works. So the truth lies somewhere in between. The question is where? So we have, I think, established that the changes that we've been talking about in the way people are able to consume and the way people are able to get ahead has been not necessarily a deliberate action on the part of baby boomers, but simply the effects of policy changes that weren't not necessarily what we expected them to be.
Well, I think not just policy changes, but also technology.
Technology.
Innovative technology has changed the world that we live in. I mean, you can sort of make the case, Shelley, that if you look at, you know, the way in which we live our lives today and the devices that we use to live it are so different than they were 50 years ago or so, that, you know, technology has to be considered in there.
Sure.
Independently of change, policy changes that we make.
Yeah. And social media comes to mind as one of the big technologies that isolates people and has the ability to really change society because people don't need to talk to each other.
Well, it isolates people, but on the other hand, it lets very small fringe groups gather together far more easily than they did, let's say, in the 1960s. And you've got some examples of that, Michael.
Well, one of the things is you go back again in American history and you look at extremism or conspiracy theories.
Sure.
Almost none of them are new. I mean, the details are new. But the notion of a secret global cabal led by the, you know, British royal family and the Rothschild bankers, you can find, you know, and child pedophiles drinking the blood of kids, you can find that anytime in the 19th century.
And every immigrant group has felt, you know, tremendous hostility on the way in.
But I was going to say that those people who publicized those conspiracies in the 19th century had a range of about 25 miles. They wrote a local newsletter that had a mimeograph machine. It never went beyond that. The same guy who believes that, you know, the Democratic National Committee kidnaps children and drinks their blood now has a global range with the press of a button.
You mean that's not true?
No, I don't think so.
So dare we go into the future a day and a half and talk about AI?
Which is, I could not think of anything that I know less about than that, particularly generative AI. But, you know, I was laughing about this with Michael, talking, preparing for this, saying, you know, when you reach singularity, which is when AI is as smart as we are, you know, maybe they'll do a better, maybe AI will do a better job than we have.
Well, there's always that possibility. Because it can consider more a bigger range of outcomes before it reaches a conclusion than normally we can. But hopefully our instincts are better.
Hopefully. But I think that's certainly something that is going to be extremely interesting as we go to the future. I mean, as a professor, how on earth can I tell whether or not my student has written an essay or not, or a term paper anymore with ChatGPT? How can you do that? Right. I haven't got any particular way that I know that I can tell whether this was written by the individual who's taking my class, or they just type in the right words to ChatGPT.
Which leads to a whole discussion that was had during the week in a different context. The idea that you should only grade students based on test results, not on any of the softer stuff, because the softer stuff could have come from anywhere.
Right. Test results in class.
In class.
Right. In class, right. But the difficulty with that is that many of our courses these days are online.
Sure.
Or a hybrid, partially online. I mean, the notion of everybody sitting around in a classroom, you know, while it certainly still exists, that certainly is not the only way in which we deliver education to people, you know, here at the University of Arizona or around the world.
But also, when we talk about college education and even you know, secondary education, aren't we talking about teaching people to think critically and to not just, you know, mark A, B, C, or D on a test? Isn't part of learning the whole idea that abstract thinking and the way you come up with a thought process and an answer process, debating things, thinking about them, isn't that part of what education is about?
In theory.
Oh, you guys are both staring at me like I have three heads.
Maybe we're just jaded college professors after a lifetime wondering, you know, how much value we've added. But, you know, I was taken a few months ago when ChatGPT first was emerging in, you know, in newspapers and so forth. One of my colleagues circulated an essay written by artificial intelligence on the colonial Spanish economy. And I thought it was pretty good. I learned something from it. But interestingly, my colleagues who are still teaching, I'm retired, they were very critical of it. They thought it was second rate, a C at best. But I think they were really kind of threatened by it because it was pretty good.
And how long ago was this?
This was 6 months ago.
Just 6 months ago, yeah. So it was pretty good. You know what we're going to do? We're going to come back and we're going to talk about potential solutions. So what I'd like to do a little bit earlier than usual is take a break, remind everybody that since 1970, Green Things has been the go-to place for your gardening needs. Green Things is on a lovely 13-acre site that is also the home to the Socolo Village and all of those fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art stores. Green Things on River Road, just west of the Brandy Fenton Park, and on the web at greenthingsaz.com and socolovillage.com. We'll come back with these two professors, and they're going to help me solve the problems of the world.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane and North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. On the web at noblehops.com. The Regional Transportation Authority Plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax. The RTA tax is collected throughout Pima County and averages about $100 million in revenue each month.
The RTA is the largest annual funder of regional transportation projects in the region. The RTA tax funds priority projects that were approved by voters in 2006. See details in the latest RTA annual report at rtamobility.com.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We're also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rito River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Cushman & Wakefield Picor is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield Picor offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at picor.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's picor.com. Call us at 748-7100.
The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
This is John Trout. Catch me every weekday morning at 5 before Wake Up Tucson with America in the Morning. Breaking news, weather, politics, and sports on 1030 KVOI, The Voice.
And we're back. Shelley Fishman sitting in for Bill Buckmaster from the Green Things Zocalo Village studio with Professors Brinton Millward and Michael Schaller. And we're talking about stuff that has made it harder for younger folks, younger than us, to get to and rise into the middle class. And one of the interesting things that's happened in the course of these 2 hours is that my view of maybe it's my fault has been moderated a little bit to maybe we just didn't understand the scope of the problem and the solutions that we were proposing over the past 40 or 50 years. So let's talk about solutions. How do we solve this, guys?
Well, certainly, there's no way to solve it with one magic bullet.
Oh, come on!
I mean, if you're going to put a gun to my head, okay, and put a gun to my head, I would say if you take a look at the United States, we have birth rates below replacement. That's 2.1 children per woman. Again, this is a problem of success. Women have greater economic opportunities and more personal freedom. Yet it comes with a cost. Falling birth rates mean shrinking populations that heighten economic pressures of aging societies. So what is my solution? Immigration. Now, I realize this is the third rail of American politics, which is you touch it and you die, right? But if you have any doubt about what immigrants have added to this country's economic success, look at the CEOs of Pfizer and Moderna that developed the vaccines that saved us from the worst ravages of COVID. Look at innovative technologies in areas like biotech, AI, pharmaceuticals, and computer technology. You'll find the same pattern of immigrants being prominently in the generation of those technologies. Now, it's not just in the area of sort of highly educated. Take a look at small business, from restaurants to lawn care to healthcare to the building trades. You'll find immigrants building our economy as well. With a historically low unemployment rate of 3.5%, you know, they're not taking American jobs.
In fact, very often they're taking jobs Americans don't want.
That's true. Or they're creating new jobs that didn't exist before.
Right.
Because one of the things we know about people who migrate, they are innovative. They have to be. They decide to leave everything behind them.
But
just like we did when we came to the new world.
I mean, they want to get Social Security, and they want to have health care, and they want their kids educated. We can't afford all that.
Well, they pay taxes.
They pay taxes.
They pay taxes.
Oh, there's that. Ah, okay. So one of the solutions is the problem that you're defining is the problem of a shrinking population. And in the face of a growing economic model,
right.
You need to bring people in to get this work done.
Unless you want to be like Japan, which is sort of in the last, I mean, they're going to sort of turn out the lights. The rate of population decline is so great in Japan, they're giving away houses.
Right.
Italy as well.
So our success is that
people
still want to come here.
Giving away houses in Italy?
Yeah.
I'll see you guys.
You want one? You have to, I think, upgrade it.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, along the lines of what Brent was saying, that immigration is a third rail politically. Same, similarly with Social Security, okay, which is a foundation of retirement security
right.
for most Americans. It is a system created in the mid-30s. Things have changed. The nature of work has changed. Longevity has changed and so forth. But it isn't and conservatives often say it's a Ponzi scheme. You know, it depends on the last one in paying for it. None of that's true. But there are issues, as with a declining population, contributions decrease. How are you going to pay for it?
Clearly, how you're going to pay for it is a very important
right.
question with Medicare and Social
right.
Security.
And there are a dozen ways to make it viable. First of all, it's not going to go bankrupt, as is often said. It's going to, you know, if nothing is done in 10 years, it'll pay 75% of what it's pledged to. But there are a dozen changes to make.
The changes are not so onerous.
That's right.
That people will suffer from those
right.
changes.
And of course, the sooner you implement them incrementally, the less onerous yeah. they are. And, you know, one is an obvious one, but it has problems, increasing the age of retirement.
Sure.
That's fine for white-collar workers,
but
it's not great
right.
for blue-collar workers.
But let's just I love the subject, and you know, Bill and I have discussed this on this station several times. The reason I want to cut you a little bit short on it is because Social Security is kind of at the end of somebody's
right.
Career in life, and I'd like to focus a little bit more attention on getting Gen Z and you know, millennials and all these, you know, amorphous kind of generational definitions in a better place, because if you listen to them, they're not in a good place now. So that gets us back to solutions, you know, that
to the sort of the Gen Z, millennials, and other generations, the lack of a good place. I think one of the things you need to do is to, we do a very poor job in this country of retraining people for work. One of the things about an economy, a capitalist economy, is it's great on creative destruction. And so you don't have the kinds of guaranteed jobs that you may have had in previous generations. That's not the fault of the boomers. It's just the way it's the changes that our economy is and technology have brought to us.
Yeah.
So the government could do a much better job of sort of making the labor market more efficient, and people get the training they need if they lose their job in one area to move into another. Now, those people have to be willing to do that. You can't just assume that because you've been doing the same job your whole career that you're going to be able to do that. I do think some of the younger generations are much better about this and being flexible and being able to move from one job to the other.
So when I was growing up, you know, you worked for a company for 40 years, you got your gold watch yep. and retired. And then came Reagan, which is where we started this show today, and he did something that had incredible unintended consequences. And it's called the 401k. The 401k is a, you know, a way that you can contribute and your employer can help you contribute to your retirement. It's a great plan, except it's portable. So it doesn't stay with any corporation. It stays with the person who has been saving toward that 401k, which meant that your loyalty to that corporation was no longer tied to your retirement benefits, which meant you had no loyalty to that
Well, that was certainly, Shelley, if I could interrupt, I'm sorry.
No, by all means, I'm preaching.
I'd say that was one of the issues. But the other one is 401ks and these, you know, personal retirement plans certainly worked out pretty well for higher income Americans.
Absolutely.
But if you look at, again, the distribution of, you know, working class or lower middle class people, either they didn't have a 401k or the contributions were minimal. And it didn't make up the difference between what a traditional retirement was, and it wasn't really enough to supplement Social Security.
Right. But the unintended consequence I was talking about was getting back to what Brent was saying, which is somebody has to retrain workforces all throughout, you know, the lifetime of workforces. And one of the things that I noticed when I was growing up and, you know, working in the corporate world was my corporation went out of its way to get me trained because they thought I was going to stay there for 40 years. When the average worker today goes through 9 or 10 jobs in their career, what motivation does the corporation have to pick up that responsibility?
Well, I think the corporation has very little if that's the case. That's why there is a role for government.
Bingo.
When you have these hollow corporations where you have, they're essentially a nexus of contracts. And so you, instead of one corporation, you were at AT&T, right?
I was, yes.
You were at AT&T, which was sort of the classic behemoth industrial, you know.
It was. When I was there, the largest corporation in the world.
The largest corporation in the world. And so everything was internalized. But now everything is externalized. And that's why we've got to figure out how you do this when no one party is running the whole show.
I mean, the word that comes to mind is government.
Yeah.
But
bad as it is.
Bad as it is. And that immediately raises the question of how do you pay for it?
Again, taxes.
Taxes.
Of course, as they say, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax the guy behind the tree.
Oh, there's a guy hiding behind the tree.
But we see that right now.
Sure.
In the debt crisis, right? You know, whether to raise the national debt, right? Again, it isn't an impossible. I mean, you're not going to pay off $31 trillion in a year or two or even 10.
And you might not have to.
Right. But figuring out how to balance it better is not rocket science, right? The one thing we can say is we know proposals to throw people off food stamps unless they work is, you know, it's meaningless economically. It's a moral, you know, righteous stand.
Right.
But again, without the notion of a government that plays a mediating role in this, you're not going to solve the problem.
Right. Well, also, we have some problems that are kind of endemic. We're paying 19% of our GDP for medical care in this country. The rest of the industrialized world is paying about 11%. That's about an 8% of GDP cost that our economy is bearing that our competitors do not bear. When you take that and you look at the fact that we're spending about 6% of our economy on military, when the rest of the world is hard-pressed to go to 2%, that adds another 4%. So now you've got over 10% of our economy that we are paying for stuff that we could fix without changing taxes.
Right.
So you wonder about, are these problems fixable or does nobody want to fix them?
Politically, parties want an issue.
They want an
more
issue.
More than a solution.
Right.
Social Security, immigration, taxation, you know. These are soluble problems. It's not like, you know, figuring out time travel. But if you don't want to solve it, there's no way to solve it.
I'm glad you said it's solvable. I don't know how to solve all of them, but that optimism is where I'd like to end this. We're in the last minute of the show. I'd like to thank you both, Professor Schaller, Professor Millward. I definitely want to thank John Davison, our engineer and producer, because he's kept this thing running. I want to thank our audience. We've had good participation from our listeners. And this has been a really great 2 hours. It's rare that you get the opportunity to do this. So thank you guys for coming. And let's work on these problems.